Welcome to Open Book on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is John Fisher, Artistic Director of Theater Rhino in San Francisco, which is now showing Fighting Mac through June 19th at Thick House, which is a theater located at 1695 18th Street at Arkansas. And for more information on that, go to therhino.org. John Fisher has been the Artistic Director of Theater Rhino now for 8 years. Now they're moving around a bit rather than being in one location, which is both, I guess, freeing and at the same time a little scary, which we'll talk about. But first I want to talk about Fighting Mac. Theater Rhino is the oldest queer theater in America, and Fighting Mac is about the only gay, out gay in a way, soldier from the British imperialist days. He was a war hero, 1853 to 1903, and wound up killing himself when his sexuality became exposed. You've said that you've known about him for a while then?
Yeah, I became interested in British imperialist people, these kind of adventurers, since I fell in love with the movie Lawrence of Arabia. I've always been fascinated by not just the military side of them and the adventure side of them, which captured so beautifully in old Hollywood movies, but also their sexuality. And there was a strain of homosexuality that ran through all of these imperialists. Lawrence of Arabia, of course, famously gay and sadomasochistic on top of it, and also Gordon of Khartoum, and Hector MacDonald, who was the only one who was actually outed in his lifetime and purportedly committed suicide, although our play posits a possible alternative. There's a myth that surrounds what might have happened to him as opposed to him having killed himself. And that was very important to me, too, because, of course, the typical narrative of a gay man from the old Hollywood days is they had to die at the end. And I wasn't sure that's how I wanted my portrayal of a gay man to end. So we offer up an alternative ending.
How much of that alternative ending is based on history, or is it just conjecture?
It's not just me. For many years, until the mid-60s, there was another version to what happened to him, where he went after he disappeared, and whose body was actually discovered. I think most historians refute this alternative history, but it hasn't been completely refuted. And there's a very mysterious character who pops up in the German army at the end of World War II, who happened to be the only successful German general during World War I. And I don't want to give it away, but we put out there a perhaps wickeder ending to the story of Sir Hector MacDonald, and I hope a fun one.
You also have Kitchener as gay.
Yes, I do. Kitchener as gay. I was very interested to discover that in the Wikipedia entry on Kitchener, there's a large section on his sexuality. His sexuality was much in debate, and he was a man who never married, was purported to be gay, but he was so powerful nobody talked about it. And in his mid-50s, he pursued a wife about the moment he was about to be exposed, and they didn't actually marry. So Kitchener has always been, like many famous British generals, Montgomery, Field Marshal Montgomery included, purported to perhaps have been gay. And there were many rumors. Again, no solid concrete evidence, but he did supposedly have a boyfriend who was a captain on his staff. And it's amazing because, of course, the poster, the famous poster, "I want you," him pointing, which is where our Uncle Sam poster comes from. But it's originally Kitchener pointing, "I want you." And you begin to unpack that meaning when you think of him being possibly gay.
John Fisher, how did you first discover MacDonald?
Like I said, I grew up watching Lawrence of Arabia in bits and pieces. You know, television used to have all these commercials, and they'd show the movies all chopped up. And I knew I loved Lawrence of Arabia, but I'd never seen the whole thing. And every time he was on TV, I'd like catch a half hour of it, 45 minutes of it, then I'd fall asleep, or mother would say go to bed, or, you know, the station was just showing the first half. And finally, I saw the whole movie projected on a bedsheet at NYU in the bowels of the dorm one summer. And it was so hot, I actually went down there more to escape the heat because it was coolest in the basement. And they showed the whole movie, and I was like, from that moment on, I was in love with the whole adventure of the British Empire. I'm a pacifist. I don't believe in the military as an agent of anything good, but I've always been fascinated by the adventure narrative aspects of these characters. And that really led me to an exploration of first eminent Victorians, the great Lytton Strachey book about Gordon of Khartoum, and that led me to another book, which is a follow-up to that by Byron Farwell called Eminent Victorian Soldiers. And in it, I was shocked to discover out of all these 12 generals, there was Hector MacDonald, who was accused of being gay publicly in the newspapers just a few years after Oscar Wilde. And I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. My God, my whole life I thought was coming together in this one person, gay, military fascination. And here it is. And I thought that this was a topical story because of what we're going through now with the long overdue demise of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And so that sort of played into a lot of my thinkings about history and contemporary politics. So I thought it was time for his story to be told.
We chatted before you went on the air. You began thinking about this late 2010, and yeah. You were thinking of it as just the story of MacDonald, but something else crept in.
Well, as I finished writing it, I was all getting ready to cast it and everything and find, you know, all these people with mustaches to play the roles, because mustaches are important. And all of a sudden, Obama, having had a horrible midterm election for the Democrats, all of a sudden started doing stuff. And he started doing something I never thought he'd do, which is he's basically said, you know, this is the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And all of a sudden, it was going to collapse. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't just tell this story of this old dead Victorian. I mean, that's fascinating, but I've got to bring a contemporary character into it. So in the early part of this year, I added a contemporary character whose name is Jesse. He goes to West Point. He's gay. And he discovers, as he's at West Point, that it's going to be okay to be gay in the military. The irony is that he realizes that that doesn't make his life any easier, because even though he is gay, he is in the U.S. military, and we're going through an incredibly challenging time right now with our military and its intrusions overseas. So that's a big part of his story as well.
You also have, early on in the play, MacDonald is in Afghanistan, and toward the end of the play, Jesse is in Afghanistan. So there are parallels here, but these parallels, how did they come together?
Well, my feeling about Afghanistan is that it's the graveyard of empire, and it really was the death knell of Great Britain. It was the thing that they couldn't get, and it was the thing they banged their head against. I think that there's a cautionary tale in what was going on in Afghanistan during the imperial period, and if we don't read that properly, we're going to go that same route. Of course, you know, this all makes it sound very political. It's really, the play is really an entertainment, and it's really a story about people and personalities and emotions. You know, these are incidentals almost, but important ones, because I think more and more, as I grow older, I see how a worldview and world situations impact our day-to-day lives. And I've felt this a lot in the last 10 years being gay and confronting the same-sex marriage debate and being a man who's lived with my one partner for 25 years and realizing, wow, I can't get married. And so I do see how world events affect the emotions and the day-to-day interactions of individuals.
John Fisher, how did this play come together in the context of, say, how your other plays come together? I know for a lot of writers of novels, for instance, every novel is written differently, but for a playwright like yourself, is the process the same? Is it different each time? Compare this to, say, working on the Saria piece, Sex Rev.
Very similar, actually. I mean, I confess to fancying myself an auteur of the stage. I mean, I think of myself as a little Godard or David Lean, you know, everything. I have to have my fingers in everything. And my collaborators, I keep working with the same ones because they're very patient. And at this point, they listen to me, and then they convince me that I'm wrong a lot of the time. But I have my fingers in everything, so part of writing the play is thinking who's going to be in it, because then I fashion the material to the actors. And that way I draw inspiration from Woody Allen and how he fashions his material, going all the way back to Annie Hall, where he was writing stuff for Diane Keaton. And I have a lot of the same actors I use. I use a lot of the same collaborators. You know, what we do is we just kind of slog through a many-month process of design, of casting, of rehearsal, of refashioning, of rethinking, of re-choreographing. And it's a real developmental process that I enter into with a lot of people that I love and respect. The Jose Saria piece was a very interesting experience. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we had a horrifying event, which was, it was an unauthorized biography of a public figure. And suddenly he found out about it and he wanted to come see it. And the night he came, I thought I was going to wet my pants. I mean, I was like horrified that he was going to stand up in the middle of it and, like, you know, like yell at us. But he showed up with his entourage, which was huge. And he was very respectful and very complimentary and supportive, but it was very scary. His agent had to explain to him that he is a public figure, so I could do a play about him, but I still felt bad. I felt like, you know, what if somebody did a play about me? And I thought, oh, I'd want to be there on opening night. But I also thought of the things that we put up there that he might have been shy about. And one of them was his ex-boyfriend, Jimmy, and how Jimmy had committed suicide. That had to be drawn out of him in one interview. And I knew that he was very shy about it. We made it a very big part of the play because we wanted to use it to explain why he fought the criminal justice system, which had basically driven his boyfriend to suicide. And so I was very nervous that he would be upset about that. Fortunately, he wasn't, and he said to the actor who played Jimmy, who was very well endowed, he said, Jimmy wasn't that big. So I thought that was a real nice sense of humor on the part of Jose Saria, that he could look beyond something that he felt was too secret to say and sort of play with what we'd done with it. He did have one criticism. He told me about something that I had gotten very wrong, what had happened to him in prison. It struck me that when we do the show again, and we're going to do it again in October, that I am going to change that, because that was the one thing that he, through all the stuff, he felt important enough to say to me. But he's such a charmer. I mean, you know, he's just like, I mean, he was the first activist. I mean, in his own way, he's a Sir Hector Macdonald or a Lawrence of Arabia. He is a pathfinder. Long before anybody, it was even remotely legal, he just kept doing it, kept defying the police, kept going out in public and drag, kept putting on his drag shows, talking openly about being queer. And I just don't think we'd have anything right now. We wouldn't have Mark Leno or Tom Amiano or anything if it weren't for Jose Saria. He's still alive. He's still the Empress, the Widow Norton. This is what I love about camp, is when it becomes political. He takes camp and makes it political, but makes it all right. You can embrace what he's doing or you can laugh at it. But even if you laugh at it, you're acknowledging that it has credence, that there is value there.
And Rhino's doing the revival.
Yeah, we're doing the revival, and I am going to invite him. And, you know, we want him involved, and we hope he markets for us to the Imperial Court. We had one court member come, and we have a moment where the audience gets to talk about, does anybody here have memories of Jose Saria? And it's amazing what people say, the stories. Sometimes they're like, it's like I want to make them part of the show. I mean, and that's a part of the show. You know, the audience gets to participate, because that was part of his shows. The audience participated. They got up and sang along with him. And so we make that a part of our show. He's also an inspiration to me because as I get older, I think he's in his 80s. I think he's 90 this year. And as I get older, he's so on it. He's so alive and aware and there. And that's why I have trouble killing off Hector Macdonald at the end of my play. I don't want him to die. I want him to go off and fight other wars and win other victories and thumb his nose at all these losers who persecuted him.
Where is Sex Traffic going to be?
It's going to be at Counterpulse, which is this great little sort of alternative performance space on Mission. In the good part of Mission, Theater Rhino is no longer in the bad part of Mission. It's just a cool space that we can turn into kind of like a cafe, like the Black Cat where Jose originally performed.
John Fisher, getting back to Fighting Mac, after you had finished the piece, you worked with a dramaturg who made some suggestions. How does a dramaturg work with a playwright who's also the director and one of the actors?
Well, I think you put it best, and I've never heard it put this way, and it was just so succinct. You said, we were talking about it, and you said, oh, he's an editor. I'm like, yeah, he's an editor. He does as much as he can to communicate with me in all of my capacities. And if I disagree, he accepts that. But he really advocates for the script outside of the playwright. What does the script want to do outside of what the playwright, having now created the script, wants it to do? Usually the playwright kind of wants to let it alone. I mean, we all think as writers that we've created, you know, the Iliad or something. It's perfect, right? And the dramaturg advocates for the script. And the first thing he said to me, I was telling you this, he said, you've got two stories. One's contemporary. One takes place in 1900. One's about a boy at West Point who's gay. One's about Hector Macdonald who's gay. They're not talking to each other. Why can't these two people talk to each other? Why can't this boy at West Point talk to... And I was like, I don't know. And he said, were you afraid of having them talk across time? And I'm like, no, that doesn't bug me. And he said, well, why haven't you done it? I said, it just didn't occur to me. So I put those scenes in. And he's really helped me get the tissue connected to take what was like at one time, like a Frankenstein created from separate pieces and turn into a living being that, you know, the arm is connected to the shoulder, which is connected to the lungs, which is, you know, and he's helped me get it breathing. He also helps with the directing. He tells me, you know, when those boys march around, their hands are not in the right place. They don't look like they're at West Point. Get their hands moved. And as an actor, he's all over me. He's like, you were camping tonight. You were mugging. You were pushing. You were, he says, relate to the other actor on stage. John, what are you doing? You're up there. I said, well, I was getting laughs and I wanted to get more. He said, yeah, but the character doesn't want laughs. The character wants what the character wants. Get back to what the character wants and stop mugging for laughs. I'm like, okay.
I've seen enough of your plays, John, that I know that there's a tendency in the work of John Fisher to make more is more. And I guess someone at some point has to say, well, you know, sometimes less is more.
Yeah, less is more. I mean, I remember reading about Jack Nicholson. He said, I'm a big believer in less is more. I was like, Jack Nicholson? And then I was like, Jesus, can you imagine what he's like before the director gets a hand on him? He was like, less is more. And I'm like, that's less? And so I've always taken inspiration from Jack in that it's time to listen to people because I feel like I give so much. If they say, you know what, if you just pull back, it'll at least bring some variety to what you're doing. And so I think, okay, Jack's one of my heroes. I'm going to go the way of Jack.
There's a signature moment for John Fisher in Fighting Mac, the use of miniatures. And I've noticed this in all of your plays. Is it a signature moment? Is it like Hitchcock walking on stage?
Yeah, it hasn't been all my plays, but I think some of the ones I've been seeing the most, like Cleopatra the musical, Medea the musical, yeah, there have been little people. In this case, it's more me making fun of myself. You know, I'm just sort of like making fun of my enthusiasm. You know, I always think of that movie Rushmore and how that came out after I'd done all these miniatures, and yet here was this character being portrayed as like a little maniac, and he had miniatures in his play, and I took that as some sort of validation that miniatures are cool. So I put it into this play, and there's just one moment. I don't overdo it. It's just sort of making fun of the character who puts on a play about Hector McDonald. And it's juxtaposed, I feel like, with the brutality of the battle scenes, which are anything but miniatures. There are people strangling each other and kicking each other and, you know, killing each other. So, you know, it is signature, I guess.
Theater Rhino gave up its two theaters and is now traveling. What happened?
You know, it was the Edifice Complex. We had an edifice. We had a building that was big and spacious and cost a lot of money to run. And what was happening was basically we were working for the landlord. All the money was going to pay rent. And when I realized that I was not able to support the artists in the way I wanted to, I decided it was time to give up the edifice. The landlord was intransigent, and so we decided to go on the road and become an itinerant theater company. What's always been most important to me about Theater Rhinoceros is the people, not the edifice. I was not a big fan of that edifice ever because of the neighborhood, and the neighborhood has never turned around. And although it never bothered me, I thought it was sort of hip and cool, I realized that theater audiences expect a certain level of security when they go out late at night. They're not clubgoers. I mean, we're a very different group of people, theater audience, than clubgoers. And, you know, I sort of felt like it was turning into Times Square in the 70s, just brutal. Now we're in nice theaters in nice neighborhoods. We're able to rent a proscenium theater when we want a proscenium, a black box when we want a black box, theater in the round when we want to do that. So we're no longer constrained by our neighborhood, our escalating rent, the bad economy. This has been a great way to keep the product coming and not worry about the diminishing foundation support. For me, it's been a completely positive thing. I think the perception is that it's good to have a home, but like Frank Sinatra, I've been a rover, you know. I find love wherever I find love, and fortunately, there's been good, we've had good experiences with the theaters we've rented.
Do you now kind of pick the theater based on the play, or?
Yeah, absolutely. You put your finger right on it. I mean, that's really what I love most about it. When we did the Stephen Sondheim musical, we were at the Eureka, which is associated with musicals. It's a nice proscenium theater. It just felt like a Sondheim neighborhood. The Jose Saria was in a much more rough and tumble kind of theater in kind of an edgy neighborhood surrounded by clubs and things. And Thick House is sort of somewhere in between. It's bourgeois. Oh, they hate us at Thick House. The neighbors, they hate us. All the battle scenes, they hate us. Oh, my God. When we go past 10 o'clock, they bang on the loading dock doors because I recreate like the entire, you know, history of American conflict over the last 100 years. It's a noisy-ass play.
I understand that your own play, Ishii, is going to be in Berkeley now with a bigger cast and full sets and everything?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny you said earlier you were talking about sort of the scope of these things, and I posited that I thought I was David Lean. And I mean, the only problem is that I'm like David Lean with a $400 budget, you know.
You're a very lean David Lean.
Very lean David Lean. There's like there's no fatty tissue of a monetary nature in my career. So every once in a while, I'll do a show and it'll get enough attention that somebody else will pick it up and do it in a more elaborate venue. And that's what's happening at UC Berkeley. And I could not be more excited because those guys are great. I mean, they've got an incredible department with incredibly talented actors and creative staff. And so I think Ishii's going to finally get the production it deserves, not because I deserve that production, but because Ishii does and his history at the University of California.
Have your works been performed by others with other people directing?
Yes, they've been done in Seattle and New York with other directors with mixed results. There have been productions I thought were wonderful and productions that I thought didn't crack the egg. You know, not that I write eggs. I feel like if you crack it and cook it right, you can make a really nice quiche. That doesn't always happen. In some cases, it does. And I'm very gratified by those.
You said when we were talking about this the other day, you mentioned to me that one thing that you hope for is to answer the questions that are in the script. Mm. What does that mean exactly?
I think a play asks a lot of questions, and it's the director's responsibility to answer them and to communicate the answers to the audience.
Give me an example.
Well, Shakespeare's the best example because we don't always understand what he's talking about, and we have to do a lot of research to find out. But any playwright who writes a play, even now, doesn't want to explicate everything because that's not writing. Writing is about suggestion. It's about metaphor. It's about approaching meaning elliptically because that is flattering to all of us. As a writer, as an audience, we want to find the X in the equation. And if the equation is just, you know, 4 = 4, we don't feel like we're accomplishing anything, or we feel like we're accomplishing something that's very low energy requiring from us, like television. Television lays it all out there for you in most cases. And that's fine because people watch television very passively. Going to the theater is very active. And so we need to feel like, as an audience, we're being led down a difficult path so that we can feel the success of arrival at the end. And what that means is that a script doesn't have everything explicated. Everything isn't there on the written page. Things are suggested. They're inferred. They're talked around sometimes. And a director and the actors involved need to find the meaning and create the meaning and communicate the meaning to an audience.
What's the difference between that, or is it the same as creating clarity?
Clarity is, I think, the next step. I mean, even when you've done that, I think there are many technical aspects of theater that will help trumpet that. And actors and directors can have done the work of knowing what a play is about, but maybe they're not communicating it well enough. And a very simple example, and one that we struggled with on this production, was diction. You know, the actors need to really articulate. They need to speak up. These are the basic tools of the actor. But there's also dramaturgical things, and sometimes things need to be changed. Clarity, I think, is folded into the process, but it's also more at the end of the process as a refinement. It's the whole process of going from coal to diamond. And the clarity, I feel, is the polishing.
And the audience themselves, when I talked to Carrie Perloff, she was saying that people on stage, it's harder for a director, but people on stage always know whether the audience is with you, behind you, or ahead of you.
Getting ahead of you, this is why we talk about pace. The audience needs to be able to follow the story. If the show is going too slow, if the actors aren't picking up the pace, the audience is going to get ahead of them. They're going to hear what the answer to the question is before it's said. And then you're going to lose them because they're going to feel like they're not with the show, they're ahead of it. When you're on stage, and I know this from being on stage, you know exactly what's going on in that audience. And don't ask me what. It's not about laughs. It's not about silence. It's not about hearing the pin drop. It's, you know, those are all cliches. It is just the chemistry, the electricity of theater, of live theater. There's no explaining that, but you know it. You know it absolutely. I had a moment where I knocked over a glass during the performance on Saturday. It flashed in my mind to pick the glass up, but I let it dribble because I knew it was interesting to the audience. And I just delivered my line slowly on top of the dribble, and I felt the effectiveness of that moment of me dribbling out my words as the water dribbled, as opposed to picking up the glass, acting like it didn't happen, and saying the lines at the usual pace I say them, which is much faster. at the end of the line, I picked the glass up. It was a moment I felt through accident that I had the audience and that if I denied the moment, I would be denying them and not paying them the respect of, you saw this happen. Let's not pretend it didn't. I think that that's what we all talk about when we talk about being on stage and knowing exactly what the audience is experiencing at any given moment. Now, this is the problem. Now, this is the danger. The next performance, I was like, I'm going to knock over that goddamn glass. But now you're taking a mistake and trying to turn it into, you know what I'm saying? You can't play with reality, the gods of the theater that way. If you knock that thing over by accident, you've walked into something. You turn it into a set thing, you haven't.
That's one of the things about theater is that you never know what's going to happen.
You never do. And that's the tough thing. I gave a commencement address at Berkeley this June, and I talked about the mistakes. We have to embrace the mistakes. That is what we're there for. That's what makes us different, is the mistakes. That was my moment with the glass. I'm like, are you gonna preach this? Or are you gonna preach it and act on it? And I was like, okay, here's a mistake. Do it.
What other kind of mistakes have happened of that sort through the years? Do you remember any others?
I remember my first play ever in high school was Arsenic and Old Lace, and the set was beautiful, but it was so janky in construction that the doors didn't shut. You'd shut a door and it would drift open. So the set designer put clips on the doors. So whenever you left the stage, you had to clip the door behind you. But then you had to be standing back there to unclip it for the next person to come off. Well, of course, on opening night, the person who left the room before me clipped it behind me and then went back to the dressing room and had a Coke. And I was trapped on stage. I could not get off the stage. I was trapped on the stage. Richard, there was no place to go except to jump into the audience. So I picked up a shovel, which was part of the set, and I started hammering on the door with all my might, and the whole set was shaking. The whole set. And the audience went crazy. They thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. You know, I was knocking on it, thinking I could break it open, but nothing happened. So then I put the shovel down. Somebody had heard the knocking, run over, unclipped the door. So I went boom, 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 boom for like 30 seconds. The set shaking, the audience laughing. Then I put the shovel down, walked away. And the door drifted open behind me. And it was a completely absurd moment, which if you had rehearsed it and said it, would never work. And, you know, the audience just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. This guy couldn't get a door open with a shovel, but it would just drift open behind him. And I think what everybody loved about it was it truly looked like the door had a personality.
Michael Frayn talks about Noises Off and said that he's seen performances where the audience is falling on the floor, but he's also seen performances where the timing is off. And you've got a comedy that no one laughs at.
Oh, my God. Farce. Farce is horrifying. A two-hour play that's a farce, and you get 5 minutes into it, and you know the audience doesn't get it, and you got another hour and 55 minutes of doing this shit, it's horrifying. I mean, with drama, you know, in a way you're safe because, you know, you're not relying on laughs. But a farce that they don't laugh at, and I've done farce that nobody's laughed at, and people have come backstage and said, oh, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen. I said, why the hell weren't you laughing? It's like, well, nobody else was laughing, so I was scared. I didn't want to make noise. I mean, so you never even know what's going on with that audience.
You said to me the other day that in my interview with Sondheim, he made some comment. You just answered the question there.
Sondheim said to you, he said, just because an audience is laughing and clapping a lot doesn't mean they're necessarily enjoying themselves. And I don't know if that was like a defense of his entire career.
But the other side of it is if an audience isn't doing that, they may be enjoying themselves.
Well, I think that that's the flip side. And I think that that's what he's talking about. I think what he's found over the years is the experience of putting on shows that he meant to be like laugh out loud funny. But if you stop to laugh during I'm Still Here, you're going to miss the next lyric. It was like the old Cole Porter problem, you know. Been called a commie.
What, from I'm Still Here?
Yeah.
I've been called a pinko commie. Tool, got through its stinko by my pool.
Right.
I should have gone to an acting school. That seems clear.
If you laugh at any one of those things, you're going to miss the next thing. And I think that Sondheim, what he's saying is audiences are enjoying themselves. And the laugh out loud sound they feel is going to prevent further enjoyment. And it's the difference between enjoying something in the theater and walking out of the theater and thinking about something. Like, what did I just see? I just saw a woman sing about her entire career. She has one song in this entire show, and she summarized the entire experience of a career in the theater. And you're going to think about that for 2 days, as opposed to just having the memory of having laughed a lot. And so I think that we all find these kind of gray areas in theater with relation to the audience. live audiences. It's the most fascinating phenomenon in the world.
Would you feel better if you walked outside and found people talking about your play and not liking it or not talking about it at all?
The experience of talking to people afterwards is a very interesting experience, and I've had to learn a lot about it. Oftentimes people don't say anything about it, and you immediately think they didn't like it. In fact, what I think is going on is they've had to listen to you for 2 hours. Now they want to tell you what's up with them. In other words, the communication is a social one, and you'll go out and see them, and they'll say, oh, we really enjoyed it, and you'll say, how are you? And then you'll have a conversation with them about them. And I think the important thing is not to be defensive about that, because expecting people to gush isn't really what it's about. It's really about them feeling comfortable enough, first of all, to wait to talk to you, and then secondly, to share with you. I think that's the ultimate compliment. They see something. I had a guy say to me, he said, you know, I'm old enough to have experienced all of the forms of homophobia you portray in this play. And then he started rattling them off. There was a time when I'd be like, Jesus, why aren't you talking about my little people or my battle scenes? Or, yeah, me. But in fact, I found myself like really being touched by the fact that he was taken to a place of memory in his life by what he'd seen. And he never, you know, he told me he liked the acting. I mean, he did compliments me, but mostly he wanted to talk about himself. And I think that that's a good sign.
But it's also true that I think that when you show the particular on stage, you're successful if it becomes universal.
I think that's very well put. I think that if people can relate, if they can extrapolate and turn it into their own kind of message to them, then somehow you've reached them.
John Fisher, what's next for Theater Rhino?
Oh, we have a new season coming up. We're doing Sex Rev again. I'm going to do a new play. We are going to do a wonderful gay play by Kate Fodor named 100 Saints You Should Know, which hasn't been done locally. We'll be traveling around San Francisco doing our shows. We start a little later than most theaters. We're not going to start until October, but we go through the summer. I'll tell you something. I'm really lucky. It's great to be in the midst of a production that's opening on Friday night and to be looking ahead beyond that production to a whole new set of productions in the next year.
And film, any chance of turning on a little machine and just creating a $400 David Lean production?
Yeah. I guess like all directors, I sort of fantasize about being in movies. I really would like to be a David Lean, like go off into the desert. And, you know, he like disappeared for 3 years. They couldn't get him out of the desert. They're like, you have to come back to London. He's like, no, I'm getting all this great footage. And I think every time I talk to a film person, they're like, you know, I'd really like to produce this guy's work. I just wish I had another $14 million, you know? But you're right. I mean, it's interesting. Technology is amazing. And you really can make a movie on an iPhone now. And maybe I should make an iPhone movie. If I could get a wide-angle enough lens, you know, for those desert scenes. It's all that desert that he had. Like, all those scenes of just, like, sand blowing. It's so sensual. I feel like that's the ultimate pornography. It's just those sand dunes, like, blowing onto each other. And then these men walking around basically in dresses on all this, and then sinking into the sand, right? I mean, what was that about? It's like, so that's what I want to do. I want to go out into the wilderness and just spend, like, 2 years making some mammoth, gay, adventurous epic, you know, like
Florence of Arabia.
Florence of Arabia, you know, and sort of disappear into the world of film. That's my fantasy. Until then, I'm very happy in theaters.
You've been listening to an interview with John Fisher, the artistic director of Theater Rhino, Fighting Mac by John Fisher, directed by John Fisher, and John Fisher in the role of General Kitchener, among others. Is now playing through June 19th at Thick House, 1695 18th Street at Arkansas. For more information, therhino.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.